Welcome to the Dr. Future Show. This hour, we have Ed Ellsworth in the studio, where we'll be diving into the worlds of dolphins. Ed is someone I've known for, it must be 30 years now, Ed, since I first met you and you were involved with John Lilly and his dolphins back in the early 80s.
Yes, I recall us back in the days of your planning for the Crystal Ball back at Network Nexus at 3 Twin Dolphin Drive right across the street from Marine World Africa, USA.
Yeah.
That's where I worked with John Lilly and the Human Dolphin Foundation Project Janus team, and we were talking to the dolphins.
Yes, that was my entree into the whole dolphin. Of course, I had read about this. I'd heard about John Lilly's and experiments, but then to run into you who are actually involved with the dolphins. Now, for the uninitiated, they had two dolphins, right?
Well, yeah, we captured two dolphins, two Atlantic bottlenose dolphins, and they were named Joe and Rosalie after the producers of The Day of the Dolphin. The Day of the Dolphin was a fictionalized account that was about someone assigned scientists like John Lilly that work with dolphins and weaponize them. In the movie, they showed
they put bombs on them or something like that.
That's right. Yeah. Right, and being used for reconnaissance and things.
Yeah.
Your role in that
group,
the real people, not the movie.
I worked in visual discrimination and the language work. So I worked with the Janus system, the Joint Analog Numeric Understanding System.
That was to create interspecies communications, right?
The idea was to pick a bandwidth that we could communicate with the dolphins with. There's basically ultrasound and there's whistles. Those are two
sound is really sensitive.
Sound is their primary
sense. Okay, that's
and
what I was thinking.
Is their secondary sense, which is something you might uniquely appreciate from your own family history.
Absolutely. Yeah. To really more deeply understand that, just to step back a moment and look at the dolphin as a creature. They are mammals like us, right? So they have multisensory apparatus. You said their primary senses is sound, not vision.
Yes,
and we're more
vision
oriented
so
as a species.
They're going to get the most accurate picture of their environments by sending a bunch of ultrasound clicks out and hearing the reflection, the acoustic reflection as it returns to them as it bounces off the fish or the boat or the corals or the dock in their environment.
Right. So they're
going
to
give them an acoustic picture that will allow them to visualize their environment, even if it's cloudy or they can't see.
Would it be fair to say that sound waves assemble a kind of a visual image in their minds?
Right, and the analogy for most people that comes to mind is when a woman is pregnant and they want to take a look at the fetus, they image it with ultrasound.
And dolphins do that as a matter of course.
Ultrasound is something that we've copied from the dolphins that they have evolutionarily developed, a biological sonar. We've copied that, and a small portion of their capabilities we've been able to express in our ultrasound technologies.
Wow.
Their experience of each other then includes a sort of a real-time ultrasound map of what they're looking at.
Right. So, the most information is held in the ultrasound clicks. It's that buzzing that you hear. If you've been in the water with dolphins or if you've seen underwater films of people swimming with dolphins, you may hear this buzzing kind of whiny kind of transmission that means that they're acoustically imaging the people that are in the water with them.
So, and it's kind of a clicky sound. I can almost pick her.
There's basically a rapid succession of clicks.
Right.
So they're creating these clicks, these ultrasound clicks, in some adapted sinus cavities. So basically what we use to breathe with on the dolphin has moved up to the top of their head near the blowhole where they breathe in and out. So they have to surface and they come to the surface and take a breath of air. And then they might go underwater and they might simultaneously emit whistles and clicks. The whistles appear to be more emotional expressions, and they might make a signature whistle that might be something like that's what Rosalie's signature whistle sounded like, and so she would repeat her name, and the whistle seemed to be more of an emotional expression.
Maybe
like if
personal.
She was excited, she might whistle more frequently at a sharper tone, or if she was just languishing around, she might whistle at a slower pace. But the whistles were all that we could easily create with our technology at the time, because at the time we were addressing this problem of communication with the dolphins, we had 8-bit computers.
Really slow compared
to
today.
Yeah, well, we used Apple II Plus.
Oh, I remember those.
Computers as the front end to PDP 1104, and we use the robotic programming language called Forth to basically create dolphin-like whistles with the equipment that we had.
So did you translate? What did you translate?
No, this was a transmission only. We were basically telling them what the language structure was, and they were doing it, but it wasn't interactive. Nowadays, now that we have 64-bit computers, we might have the bandwidth. We're starting to approach the bandwidth to being able to real-time do analysis where the communication really is occurring. Yeah. We'd have to actually be able to visualize the world acoustically, though, and then do a visual transform. Let's say transform it into some kind of video format that we could then interpret that. Because the problem that we have with trying to communicate with dolphins is their signal bandwidth is way up high.
Yeah, what is their range?
Right? We actually have to hardware downshift it many, many times.
Because our audio is
it into the hearing range. So
yeah, our audio is 20 to 20,000 hertz for humans.
They go up to about 200K or
200,000 hertz.
Yeah, 200,000.
As opposed to 20,000 hertz.
If we shout, we are at the low range of their hearing range.
I see.
They are shifted much higher. We have to actually downshift to bring it into our hearable range. So we arbitrarily chose whistles because we could hear them and produce them.
Right.
Our ability to accurately hear things is not as good as the dolphins.
Have we created microphones?
Basically, think about the most intelligent, with it, musical engineer, and imagine someone that a creature that had total complete understanding of sound to be able to discriminate every sound tone, but also be able to create every sound too. So they're composing and creating sounds, and they're also listening and discriminating and identifying what these sounds are in their environment. The picture I would like to paint would be, imagine a dolphin going out and sending a bunch of clicks out and those clicks bouncing back from a school of herring. They might then hear that acoustic reflection and go back to their pod of dolphins and repeat that sound. And then those dolphins would then become aware of, oh yeah, there's a bunch of food out there. Hey, let's go eat.
And they could share that with each other.
Well, yeah, that would be the most, it would be basically like hieroglyphs are a visual representation of some kind of image. You know, this icon that we look visually.
Interesting, yeah. I was wondering to translate video
these acoustic snapshots of their
acoustic language
could also.
Well, we got to go to a break right now.
Them.
But let's continue on this after the break. Thank you, Ed.
All right.
We're talking to Ed Ellsworth on the Dolphin Trail. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Ed Ellsworth on the human-dolphin communications. Ed has been on the dolphin trail for many years now and is sharing with us some of his insights into contact with that species. Now, one of the things that came up during the break, I think John asked as well, is whether or not we could teach them to speak our language or English, or did we have to learn theirs, or where is it right now? What's the status of us actually being able to communicate with them?
Well, it would be really great if we could talk to the dolphins or we could understand what they were talking about. But I think the problem is there's a certain assumption that, let's say, language is a similar kinds of organizing information for every species.
Yeah.
So let's say we talk about humans. What is characteristic about us that is different than dolphins? The big thing is
small hands.
We've got hands, yeah.
Right.
So everything that we do is referenced to ourself. It's like if I pick this up and say,
pick up a glass,
if I touch it, I can say, this is my cup.
Yeah.
So we tend to relate in terms of spatial references to objects and
to hands picking things up.
Right.
Like, go over there and get this.
Right. So if you were a non-handed species,
you wouldn't think that way.
Don't you imagine that you would not reference objects?
People can't do errands for you.
Okay. Something that we take naturally.
Yes.
Being able to possess an object and hold it and keep it. Something that simple, we don't share with the dolphins. The dolphins don't have that experience.
So they don't have personal property?
No.
Because they can't hold anything?
No pockets, man.
I see.
Hey, man, no pockets. Look, Ma, no hands.
So what does that make them all a bunch of socialists?
Well, what it makes them, the only sense of possession that I've seen them exhibit is if they're touching. Let's say they're touching a mate.
Yeah.
If they were touching a mate and making love to her, and another dolphin came to interrupt or interfere or join in that, there might be some other interaction that they wouldn't be included, because that's the only time I've witnessed
territoriality
or possessiveness is if they're actually touching a being or object. So one way they would demonstrate this would be, I'd try to teach them the concept of playing ball and sharing and passing things back and forth.
Yeah.
I would have a football and I'd go underwater with it and I'd give it to Joe. And, I'd always be giving it to him and, gesture for him to give it back.
Yeah.
And what he would do is he'd roll it up his front torso and play with it and hang on to it and do everything that he could do to hang on to it. But he wouldn't pass it off to me. It was his. He was playing with it.
Unknown concept.
And he wouldn't allow me to take it away from him.
I see.
So that's the only time I've exhibited possessiveness is when they're actually touching the object. And if you were to go in the water and, let's say, not relate to them, like pretend like they're like an object, like a horse or something, like a hobby horse, they would immediately react by possibly even ramming or hurting the person that would go in the water. So one of the things that I tried to make people sensitive to is, you know, these are beings, these are conscious beings, just like you and me, and you've got to be invited in. You don't just barge right in.
Well, no, you ran into that issue when we're dealing with a little bit of our species ego when you were introducing various celebrities to dolphins.
Right. Well, yeah, they all have...
Tell us some stories from that chapter.
It's really interesting how people would bring their shtick to the dolphins.
Yeah.
One of the funniest ones for me was Olivia Newton-John. I adore her. She's really beautiful, and it's really funny to me that she would come up, you know, in her limo and just... She obviously adored the dolphins, but her issue was, don't take any ugly pictures. But yeah, there was all sorts of people that were attracted to dolphins, and we had a steady stream of people that would come.
Like what kind of people?
Like Buckminster Fuller.
Really?
So, Carl Sagan.
Really?
And
would they jump in with the dolphins?
Rupert Sheldrake.
Oh, yes, Mr. Morphogenetic Field himself.
Yeah, and so many of these people would jump in the water with the dolphins. But like, for instance, one luminary was Werner Erhard.
Oh, the founder of EST.
He was not interested in going in the water so much as he wanted his son to go in. And he was such a forceful, angry, driving parent. And when I saw him interact in a bullying kind of way with his child, and the child didn't really want to go in the water, the child started crying.
You see a lot in these psychodynamics with
you see, you know, people's desires and fears come up quite a bit. And the funny thing is, I think probably almost all humans do share this desire to touch and swim and get close to dolphins. There's something about them that's really attractive. And I believe that attraction is that they're like an animal totem. They're actually a guide for us, and they're leading us towards possibly a more efficient way of living together and with our environment. Mm-hmm. And the way I characterize this is I talk about independence versus interdependence.
Mm-hmm. We'll go into that a little bit in a moment. That's a big topic.
Right.
And we just have a caller comes in and have a question for
you. So I just want to introduce the idea of humans.
Independence and
humans being, priding themselves, as a matter of fact, on being independent. As a matter of fact, they really would like to say, I don't need you, you know, I don't need anyone, I can do it myself.
Yeah.
Well, the dolphin's message is slightly different, and I think that a lot of us are starting to appreciate.
It's more collaborative, right?
It's literally supporting each other, and I would call that approach interdependent.
And you think having hands helped to evolve that?
Well, I think having a sense of extended family and community, we can call that a pod or a herd structure. Mm-hmm. Let's say there was a storm and a log hit a dolphin and knocked that unconscious. That dolphin has to think about every breath. So if it's not able to think about a swimming and a breath, it's going to sink to the bottom
and drown
and suffocate.
Right?
No, they never drown because they don't take another breath. They suffocate.
Oh, interesting.
So the other dolphins push it back up to the surface, and massage its sides,
so they know what's
going
on.
Starts breathing again.
Okay. We have a caller.
Yeah.
You want to bring that up?
Sure.
That's fascinating.
Hi, and welcome to the Dr. Future Show with our guest, Ed Elsworth. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I just have an experience that we were pleasured to see at, there's a small aquarium in Tacoma, and they have a huge lake, and in it was a dolphin and a beluga whale. We were watching the beluga whale just swimming behind the dolphin and swimming and swimming, and all of a sudden it's a huge, huge glass area that you can see the whole thing. And this woman steps down to the right of us, and the next thing you know, the beluga comes, stands straight up and starts rubbing the glass.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave me chills. And I said to the woman, my heavens, and she said, yeah. She said, guess what? She was retired. She came there every day, and they actually would take the dolphin out and let her get in the water with the beluga whale.
Oh, that's great.
And for some reason, this beluga whale had a total connection to this woman like it was his mate for the rest of his life. Can you imagine? I had chills. I was just like, oh, my God. I'd never seen anything like that. I spent a lot of time in the ocean.
Yeah, the beluga whale is totally fascinating. They're called the canary of the sea, and their vocalizations are really unique and interesting.
Yeah.
You've seen them also.
And they almost look like they're smiling all the time. And I mean, I just got chills to see
Well,
this.
They've got that articulated neck, too. So they look kind of like an ET, especially when they're vertically oriented.
Yeah. And she said the first time she came there, she just couldn't believe it. And the trainers saw what happened. So they asked her if she could come the next day. She came the next day. And guess what? Did the same thing.
Oh, that's great.
And so she started, and she was retired, so she started visiting this dolphin every single day. Can you imagine? I just blew my mind. You know, I'm like, oh, my God, you know. maybe we did come from the sea to begin with or something, you know, so, but well, that's just my story.
And there's some theories about that, right, Ed, in terms of human, we coming from the sea as a species?
Well, right. I mentioned that dolphins are kind of like our totem, and they've been leading us to the water and leading us to tribal and community. What Al's referring to is an earlier mention I had is that basically dolphins have been around on the planet for 30 to 40 million years. So they're really leading the way and showing us as, you know, how to survive.
Well, I experienced something at the same aquarium, and I'd never heard of this before. There was a grotto with otters, and they had their babies on their chest. And all of a sudden, I thought someone was piping and humming. Mm-hmm. These female otters were humming to their babies.
Wow.
And I think now why maybe years ago the Spanish sailors and all that thought there were mermaids.
Oh, because they had a nice humming sound. Huh.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
So I got to see two really, really neat experiences.
Yeah, beautiful.
The ocean, it was great. But I just wanted to share that. I mean,
oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, thank you so much.
Such a pleasure. I couldn't believe it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, thank you.
That's true. There's a lot of pleasure in connecting with these creatures.
Right. And definitely in terms of answering your question about evolution and about being led to the water, there is a direction that was looked at by a couple of book authors. One's called Descent of Woman, and another one's called The Water Ape.
So is this a theory where we went back to the sea and then came back to land again at some later point?
Yeah, basically, as you could imagine, at some point in the past, as we were threatened with a global warming and waters rising, basically the only place to go was to
back
be able to
water.
Continue surviving was back to the water,
So we would develop webbed fingers and that sort of thing? Evidence of that happening, that we have a certain infrastructure to our body?
One way to imagine it is
we're going to go to a break in 15 seconds.
In 15 seconds? Oh, no.
We'll answer it after the break.
This. Yes, the evolution of biology and whether or not we as humans went back to the water and then came back to the land because of some emergency in the past.
Stay tuned and you'll find out, folks, on the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Ed Ellsworth on humans and dolphins. And we were just getting into the whole crazy idea that the apes, the evolution of our species, at some point in the past went back to the ocean and then later came back to the land again and became us. Now, could you tell us more about that, Ed?
Well, fairly recently in the last 25 years, we've started in the West, started birthing babies in water.
Water birthing,
so
yes.
So actually, the first time the Western world did that was in the late 1800s in France. Basically, they were starting to have, a woman was in labor and was having a very, very difficult labor. Mm-hmm. And to relax her, to be able to get her ready for birth, they put her in a hot tub, in a bathtub. Then everything just, she started relaxing and then the birth started to happen. And they started realizing that the baby can be birthed underwater and it was a much gentler birth. So there's a whole bunch of people that have been self-selecting to be able to improve the human condition. And there's been a whole bunch of humans that have started to look at water and babies together. And so because I spent some period of time monitoring the Russian satellite Molniya and looking at Igor Tricholsky and people like that that were encouraging water training for their young youth. So they would water birth them and they would do water training in really cold water and they were preparing the next generation of cosmonauts to be able to deal with any environment at all. So part of this evolutionary push that dolphins did for us and I think that we're following their lead on is that they adapted from being a land-based animal as waters threatened their territory and the land that they were on and the predators that were on the land probably were pursuing them and the food that was plentiful was in the water, they made a gradual shift from land-based life to rivers and lakes and finally the oceans.
So they went in freshwater. They were freshwater dolphins then, initially.
Right. So if you want to look at the most, you know, less evolved dolphins that are, the ocean-going dolphins are the most evolved. They've been in the ocean for the longest period of time. But the lake dolphins and the river dolphins are more recent entries to the water. So you can see when you look at the Amazon river dolphin, that's not as smooth, not as hydrodynamically shaped as, let's say, a bottlenose dolphin. which is what we usually see in the oceanariums. And they look really, really smooth. They're very, very sleek and streamlined to be able to go very, very smoothly through the water. Whereas you look at a river dolphin or a lake dolphin, they're kind of still, they still show some of the form of the land-based animal they were before they entered the water. Or if you look like a manatee, you can see, you know, they're very slow moving and you can see their elephant ancestry, let's say, when you look at the current day manatee. Or if you look at a seal or sea lion, you can see that they were once dogs or bears. You know, you can see the similarity most of them.
I'll never forget the scene in one documentary I saw with Robin Williams where he was trying to lead a cow into the ocean and it wouldn't go. It wouldn't go into the ocean. Just, come on.
And, you can lead a cow to the water, but you can't make him swim.
And he's pointing out that they're triangulates.
Ungulates who triangulate.
Triangulating.
And so
they were related to dolphins. The dolphins were ungulates of the sea.
Well, they have similar features. So dolphins have a U-shaped pupil like llamas. They have a salt-concentrating kidney like camels. They have multiple stomachs like cows do. So, yeah, there's a lot of features in common. Yet they have carnivorous teeth. So you can see that they're...
So would sentient cows be like dolphins?
They're like, a mad carnivorous cow. But no, they're more like a wolf. They were more like wolf-like creatures that were in packs that were omnivorous.
Okay, so they could eat anything. They could eat fish, they could eat meat.
That's right. If you were to go to the Kanapali Museum in Maui, you'd see an exhibit I helped build several years ago that shows a wolf-like creature, and as you approach it, it makes some articulations and sounds at you.
Well, let's look at their culture for a second. Now, they typically live in pods. Right? Now, how big are the pods?
The way you might want to describe dolphins is they're certainly individuals. They tend to congregate and aggregate in larger herd structures.
So they are herds. You might talk about hundreds of dolphins as a herd, but you might talk about
a family structure of dolphins as a pod. So all dolphins are, they're just basically very similar to other animals that herd together. But one of the things that seems to be going on is there's really, really a lot of conscious community. Like, for instance, you'll notice when you see a herd of these, you'll see the mothers and babies near the center. Mm. You'll see more of the males and more of the guards on the outer edge.
The whole
and
structure.
What will happen structure. Is as the dolphins in a community grow up together, they start having roles. And as they take a certain role, they start having access, as they take a more established place in the community, they get to have access to the breeding females and become a family and become a pod structure. But before that, let's say the juvenile males, when they're just in a play mode and just they're not really being a food finder or a guard, they're out there playing and having sexual play with each other. But as soon as they start moving into a responsible niche with the herd, then they start forming some kind of pod family structure.
So that it's a natural structure that they form from the herd. Interesting. We have a caller, I believe.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Let's say hello to, hi, Liberty from Alptos. You've been patiently waiting. Yeah, welcome to the show.
Question for Ed.
Got a question?
Yeah, good afternoon. The lady just before the bottom of the hour jog my memory. A couple of years ago, I heard a representative from one of these marine parks, I believe it was a lady, she was talking about dolphins that basically they're party animals. They're into sex and drugs and rock and roll, and since they don't do drugs and they can't play a guitar, that leaves them pretty much with sex to party with.
I see.
She said
dolphins
tend to be pretty randy, and that they warned women, they have these things where people can go in the water and swim with the dolphins, and they warned the women that it was the wrong time of the month, they shouldn't take a chance on going in.
Have you seen any randy behavior?
Well,
I'm going to let Ed answer that. Yeah, thanks, Liberty.
I'm not sure exactly where you witnessed or relating the story from, but let me try to answer it in a kind of general way. When you have dolphins in captivity, you may see what may not be normal, natural behavior. So just like if you were to put monkeys, you know, in a zoo, you might see more sexual behavior because there's nothing else for them to do. That doesn't mean that's their natural behavior in the wild. In the case of dolphins, they do spend a lot of time touching each other, especially as they develop a pod structure or a family structure. They spend a lot of time swimming together and touching each other and kind of being in close contact all day. I wouldn't really describe that as randy, but if they do get excited and interested, they can voluntarily become erect in 7 seconds, and they have a very quick coupling act.
Do you ever see them get excited about another species like ours?
Well, the answer to that might be what the people experienced when they first started creating dolphin swim programs is they tended to notice that the female humans, when they would get in water, if there was a male dolphin, the male dolphin would get excited and become erect, and he might let's say, tow her around with his penis by the back of her knee. I've seen that happen.
By the back of her knee.
So what happened was that was kind of embarrassing for these dolphin swim operators, of course.
Yeah.
And so they
especially if it was some celebrity.
Right. So then they tend to select female dolphins for the swim program. So that
okay. Avoid those embarrassing moments.
Right.
Interesting. They don't have the hang-ups. Our species does have about sex.
Yeah, and one of the things that Dr. John Lilly noted was that they tended to use their penis as a hand or a tool. They would actually tow ropes with it, or they would interact with various objects. Towing a net or a rope or an object has been witnessed several times.
A penis as a Swiss Army knife. Well, that's built in. That's hilarious.
Person recounted an incident where there was a lady sitting on the dock with her feet dangling in the water, and a dolphin came up, and she's rubbing the dolphin's nose and leapt up out of the water and pinned her down on the dock and proceeded to attempt to have his way with her, I guess, much to the delight of the audience that was up in the stands.
I don't know. Have
you heard any stories like that, Ed?
Well, no, I haven't heard that particular story, but yeah, when dolphins are in captivity, especially like in petting pools and things like that, I've heard of people going and petting them. And I do know that you can cradle a dolphin and hold it and hug it. And I was with, for instance, Ram Dass the first time he swam with dolphins. And if any of you have been to a workshop and he's related that story, he had a very sweet experience with Rosalie, the Atlantic bottlenose dolphin that was part of the Human Dolphin Foundation experiment. He spent a nice time with her. He was on the edge of the pool in the water, just cradling her very gently, and she was just sort of melting, and he was melting, and a lot of people have that kind of experience of like intimately touching, holding a dolphin, and having the cooperation of them not trying to pull away and connecting. And so humans and dolphins are very similar in that way. We do enjoy touch, and they have a very, very sensitive skin, as any of you know that have touched them.
Yes, I heard that their body is as innervated as the head of the penis. I don't know if that's true or not, but that'd be going through the water much a different experience, I would imagine.
And plus their skin slips off. If you rub your hand over their skin, it feels
very,
very, very smooth. It just glides over. Yeah. And then we talked a little bit earlier about movement through the water. So the way they've also discovered how to move very quickly through the water is not to move linearly, like in a straight line, like humans swim in a straight line, like an Australian crawl on the surface.
So how do they swim?
They swim like a snake, like a sinus type of movement, you know, up and down, where they take advantage. There's something about water. I believe that if you're not moving linearly, but if you're moving in a curved up and down sinusoidal rhythm, you'll move actually more efficiently through the water because of the physics.
Interesting. All right. We're talking to Ed Ellsworth on the Human Dolphin Experience. We'll be back after the break.
Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're here with Ed Ellsworth talking about the Human Dolphin Experience. And was Liberty right, Ed? Like our species, there's sex, drugs, rock and roll, but in the dolphin world, there's no drugs or rock and roll?
Well, no. When that person described that scenario, I just couldn't relate to it. And he was telling the story within the context of someone at SeaWorld or some place like that.
Place where they're in captive.
Place of captivity. That's describing the way they perceive the dolphins, which is extremely limited because they're in the role of basically...
How about in the wild, though? Do they have any...
A captor and a trainer, and they're...
So they're going to be a little unusual in their behavior. They're not as stimulated out in the world, so they don't have as many options, and so...
Well, you're going to see the behaviors that they've instilled in them. Just like if you were to go to a military or ROTC thing, you might see some guards work some dogs or something, you know? There's a routine that... an agenda that humans have with those animals that is not their natural behavior. They're certainly able to learn, and when you're in a captive situation, you tend to cooperate with your captors.
Yeah. Right, gotcha. But what about music, for example? Do they have a natural, is there any evidence that they have rhythm or dance?
Love music. If you were to tune into the movie that I was in a Discovery Channel called For the Love of Dolphins, you'd see Rick O'Berry. I don't know if you know the name Rick O'Berry, but if you've tuned into The Cove, he's the activist that's been letting us know about the dolphins being killed in Taiji. Mm-hmm. So anyway, he noticed that they really like classical music. So when we're in the Bahamas or a place like that where the dolphins naturally congregate, we'll often hang speakers underwater speakers over the edge and play different kinds of music. And they respond to recorded music and live music. And we've had a number of musicians get in the water with them, a scuba air driven.
Well, they've taken their instruments out into the water
and played with them. Uh-huh. People have done percussive things with them, with drums and with didgeridoos and all sorts of music. People have gone out and played entire classical, like they brought all the members of a classical orchestra and they've gone on a platform and played to the whale. So there's a number of people that have been trying to communicate with them that way. And there's been a number of artists in our past that have interactively played with wolves, turkeys, and whales, people like Jim Nolman.
Sort of interspecies jam sessions. Huh?
Right, right. And then other artists like Paul Winter that would take those recordings and mix them really beautifully into like the Callings album.
So what have you noticed in that front? Is there any particular kind of entertainment that our species creates that they like?
When we have dolphins in a captive situation and when they're so bored, they're going to be entertained
like anything?
By almost anything. You know, it's
okay,
like,
but what about the wild? I mean, some of these musicians have gone out off the coast of Maui where they've played instruments. So they naturally get in a
Well, it's
wild,
definitely an attractor, but any kind of way of reaching out to them will tend to attract their interests. Like, for instance, one day we put a rope behind our sailboat and a bunch of us took our clothes off and got in the water. And that brought a mother humpback whale and her calf over to check us out. So yeah, they're very curious beings. And they're definitely going to, if you're doing something, they're going to come check it out. That's their world.
So I want to turn the question around a little bit. Since you have had so much experience with dolphins and more than anyone in my experience, what do you think dolphins would do if they were initiating contact with us? Like, what would their agenda be?
Well, I've heard a story of someone that got into a boat once and a dolphin came up to them and pushed them around in a grotto or a bay. Every once in a while, there's individuals that seem to come out of their community that some of us have called dolphin ambassadors. So they've actually approached humans. So for instance, I was on the dolphin trail. What I call the dolphin trail is the trail of the humans leading to the water. They're pursuing the dolphin totem imagery, the call, the clarion call, the siren call that dolphins are calling us to the water with. And there's just so many places that I was able to go and I was really motivated to go to in terms of understanding the Joe and Rosalie situation with John Lilly and the Human Dolphin Foundation. You know, we captured them when they were a year and a half old in Gulfport, Mississippi. We worked with them for several years and then finally released them back to the wild. But, you know, we couldn't release them back to where they were caught because they were so friendly now with humans that if anyone were to go in the water with them, they would have just approached them. So when the dolphin catchers go in there with their nets, Joe and Rosalie would have just gone right up to them and got caught again.
So they trust
humans.
What
we had to do was train them to eat wild fish again in the Florida Keys, and then we released them in a marine mammal sanctuary where they wouldn't get caught again. So they were actually released off the coast of Georgia. So even though they were caught off of Gulfport, Mississippi, and in the Gulf of Mexico, and they were released off of Georgia in the Atlantic, the local dolphins there, which are not the ones that came out of, they accepted them and they became part of those dolphin pods and that local herd of dolphins that probably ranged about 30 miles in that area.
So in a sense, they became ambassadors from our world theirs, in the sense they were brought up by humans and then released in the kind of like the opposite of Tarzan.
Right. And what we saw was that the local dolphins accepted them. And that was really something we didn't know. Because
they probably learned a lot about us that way.
Well, you can imagine. What if you imagine? This was like the reverse Tarzan kind of thing.
Yeah.
So instead of, you know, taking a human, having them being raised by another species in the jungle, this was, you know, humans taking dolphins in out of their environment before they had any dolphin social skills and only exposing them to the human culture. And then they're going back, putting them back in the water. Their community of dolphins probably think they're kind of retarded or kind of slow. They probably never developed any language skills. If they have such a thing as language, they may not know how to do basic things that they had to get shown.
Yeah, yeah, probably. Maybe even create a mutation or two, you know, by that.
Yeah.
Well, Do they have any kids? Were they too old to have kids?
You know, dolphins are not the sweet, angelic, unicorn, new age
animals. No, they're serious animals.
They're serious animals that, you know, if, let's say, a competitive dolphin species were to come into the area, they might actually have an interaction and ram and kill that dolphin. And I've had many stories given to me where, let's say, a mother dolphin and her calf have come into a pod trying to be accepted, and they may even kill the baby and accept the mother, the female.
Well, so
how about dolphins on Veterans Day? Like I was saying,
were there dolphin vets?
Well, there actually are Navy dolphins. And,
really?
At one time, we had three Navy facilities that trained dolphins. After I created the permit release process to let dolphins go, I worked with National Marine Fisheries Service and the Marine Mammal Commission to create a process for us to responsibly let dolphins go back to the wild. after we demonstrated that was possible, the Navy, when they went from three facilities down to one facility that worked with dolphins, they believed that they could also rehabilitate them and let them go back to the wild. So I'm really glad that we modeled that, and they also did the same thing.
So the Navy dolphins went back into their wild points too.
Yeah, and we were concerned because in the past, the Navy has always just killed their dolphins, because dolphins have been warriors that are brought onto Navy subs. They have a wet room up in the front, and they're used for reconnaissance.
Yeah.
And if you believe things like Day of the Dolphin, they were weaponized, and they were taught how to plant bombs. And they can certainly, they have a lot more flexibility than human warriors. So for instance, we know that Tuffy, the Navy dolphin, was able to dive down to 1,500 feet and take his own picture. So, you know, we were trying to look at what are the depths the dolphins can go down to and come back. Now, why is that of advantage? A human diver, if you were to go down to 1,500 feet, might have to take several hours or even days to decompress to come back up, whereas the dolphin can just pop right down, pop right back up,
you can send
and no problems.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Pat Flanagan was telling me that dolphin could go down and do a sonar reading on a like a submarine and come back and tell you what kind it was. Because they'd have samples of metal of the different hulls of different submarines, and the dolphin would be able to point to it.
Right.
Just kind of, and just, I wonder how far that they actually use that.
You mean the range of their...
the range of their capacity to identify boats, for example. Would the Navy be interested if there were, like, enemy submarines in the coastal areas? They'd be able to tell us that.
Well, I think that's the problem we're seeing right now, is we made some progress. We made certain areas to be marine mammal sanctuaries. Hmm. And then what happened is, in the history of ocean warfare, basically, Toshiba sold the silent screw technology that was used in submarines by the Soviets, so they couldn't hear the submarine propeller screws.
Yeah.
So they became interested in being able to detect these submarines, and so they started looking at the acoustic corridors that whales tend to use for their soundings. So we know that, for instance, humpback whales eat up in the Kitchen area, the Bering Straits in Alaska, and then there's three groups of humpback whales, and they come back down to the Japan and Ryukyu's island areas off of Asia. Another group comes down to Hawaii. Another group comes down to Mexico, and their song changes, and it immediately gets broadcast across the ocean, and all of them get updated. So what they're doing is they're capitalizing on certain kinds of acoustic channels and something called a thermocline.
Yeah, that's like sound travels long distance in the water through these
And if you look at the cold water and the warm water layer in the ocean, that interface between those two mediums is called a thermocline. It's like a drum skin. You can run acoustics. You know, you can
run
sound. You can detect sound, push it much further along that kind of surface
area. And they use those as natural communication channels.
Right. So what we're doing, what the Navy is doing, not we, what our military is doing is then using acoustics to be able to detect subs and do basically encrypted communications. But they're blasting it at such a volume level that it's blowing up the nervous systems of cetaceans.
Yeah, how come
whales
the Navy can't be a little smarter and just blend in with the natural acoustic channels? Why do they have to, like, harm the animals?
And their answer is it's a national defense issue, ma'am.
Well, that's nonsense.
Well, anyway, that's a big debate.
We're talking about Veterans Day and talking about military agendas in terms of that. And unfortunately, they say it trumps the environmental concerns.
Well, they could do it both ways. They could do it environmentally as well.
Yeah.
They could achieve their agenda without harming the animals.
No,
the animals don't need to be victims.
Well, they have to crank it up there for the technology to work, and they don't really care about the collateral damage.
At least yet, but we're learning to live in a multi-species universe.
Well, happy Veterans Day, folks.
How can someone find more about your dolphin trail work, Ed? How can we reach you?
Well, I'd be happy if you'd like to check out my website, dolphintrail.com. I'm also on Facebook with a page called The Dolphin Trail.
Dolphin Trail. Okay.
And you're welcome to email me at ed@dolphintrail.com. And happy trails on the Dolphin Trail.
All right. Well, thank you. Look forward to your future adventures. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much. Don Sun. Bye.
As with Ed Ellsworth, who is currently on the Dolphin Trail. And you're listening to the very end of our tale today on the Dr. Future Show.
On KSEO Santa Cruz.